Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in Californians' decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, we meet an LA street vendor whose good works are spreading to communities here. And we delve into the governor's plan to use federal coronavirus relief funds to house people who are experiencing homelessness. But first, to tackle the surge of COVID-19 cases in underserved areas, the Fresno COVID-19 Equity Project combines the medical expertise of UCSF Fresno with the outreach of community-based organizations. FM89's Sarith Hawk reports from a testing center in central Fresno.
Mobile testing sites like this one at Firm are operating at max capacity. Open 6 days a week, first come, first serve. A healthcare worker counts how many more cars can fit in the lot.
Three more.
While just outside the gates on Weldon Avenue, a long line of vehicles wrap around the block. Chandi Cha and her husband have been waiting in line since 6 a.m.
Just waiting, being patient. I hope that I'll be the next group in.
By 10 a.m., their truck is still a few cars away from the entrance.
We got here in time because the people that were coming by giving us slips to fill out, I think they stopped about 20 cars behind us.
Firm's executive director, Christine Barker, says it's normal to see cars lined up hours before the site opens at 8 a.m.
People start lining up earlier and earlier every morning. We let the cars in 25 or 30 at a time, and then everyone gets tested, goes on their way, and then we let in the next group of cars.
There's a limited number of tests that can be administered per day, around 200. It's what they can afford to do through CARES Act funding. The project hopes to reach people like Saishu Ahur and his wife. Because of their age and concerns about the virus, this Hmong couple came to get tested for the first time. A Firm employee recognizes them immediately.
My best friend's parents.
A key to the project reaching its intended targets in underserved communities is employing people from those same communities. Saishu Ahur tells community health worker Vila Yang why they came to get tested today.
They're afraid, but then because there's no vaccine yet, however, all they could do is pray and hopefully God will answer their prayer and keep them safe.
Although they're retired and stay home for the most part, they wanted to take extra precautions.
They have a daughter in San Jose that know about the site, and she recommend them to come and get tested here for their health.
In addition to offering free testing, multiple languages are spoken on site. Patients might be greeted in Hmong, Spanish, indigenous languages Zapoteco, and Mixteco, and even Efe. That's a Nigerian dialect that Theodosia Anonye speaks. She says there's not a lot of Nigerian people in Fresno, but many of them attend her church.
I do research, develop flyers, give it to my community, and let them know this place. When they're ready, they can come.
Besides a static site at Firm, the Fresno COVID-19 Equity Project conducts 1 to 2 remote testing sites per day. Community health workers like Renata Manjares often find more community members to connect with off-site.
They're surprised when we go to events and we speak like Zapoteco, Mixteco, Tlapaneco. It helps them better so they can understand us too.
Christine Barker, that's Firm's executive director, says it takes a lot of connected work in the community to be able to untangle stigmas attached to testing.
There's concern that coming to the test site will expose you, or that the test itself will give you COVID. There's just a lot of misinformation and rumors.
Can you tie mine down?
Inside the parking lot, healthcare workers suit up. gowns, face shields, and gloves. Once patient information is gathered, labels are placed on vials and individual trays are prepped with two sets of tests. The kits are then wheeled out to each car, where patients are instructed on what to do with the swabs.
You're going to take it and you're going to end up insert it in about an inch and a half in each nostril. I will let you know when you're far enough.
First, patients are given a PCR, or polymerase chain reaction test, that gets sent to a lab with results in 2 to 3 days. Then, they receive a rapid test, which can be ready in minutes. Rapid tests are processed on-site, and a 15-minute timer indicates that a result is in. People who take the test can know within the hour whether they are positive or negative. If the results differ from a PCR test, patients are contacted for follow-up. Chandi Cha, who is now a few cars away from being led into the parking lot, offers some words of advice.
Just be prepared. You're going to be staying here a long time. Bring some drinks and food because you're going to need it.
In Fresno, healthcare officials have opened up more free testing options, including a regular site at the Fresno Fairgrounds every Wednesday and Sunday. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Sarith Hawk.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. This holiday season, folks are looking for creative ways to help out, especially as the pandemic ravages some of the Valley's most vulnerable communities. FM89's Madi Bolaños has this story of an LA street vendor who came to the small farming town of Selma in the hopes of inspiring a new style of giving.
Elio Leva is lighting the grill where he will cook chicken, carne asada, and chiles. 20
minutes. But are they coming or?
He talks through the steps he'll take to make lunch for 150 farm workers. Before the pandemic hit, he owned a quesadilla stand in East Hollywood where he offered a special, buy one quesadilla, share the other for a discounted price. But when he lost customers due to the pandemic and had to close his stand, he started a GoFundMe site to help pay his bills. But then he realized he could use social media to feed others. His first step was creating a community fridge where people could donate food.
From the fridge, we discovered that there were a lot of people who had no homes, and obviously they don't have a place to cook the food, like rice and beans and things like that.
Since then, Leva says he's cooked free meals for communities in places like Menlo Park and Skid Row.
Every cookout that we do in a different place is like planting a seed, if you will.
He recalls planting vegetable seeds with his dad and brother in Mexico when he was younger. So when Fresno resident Kendra Lopez reached out to organize a community cookout in the San Joaquin Valley, he saw it as a way to reconnect with those fond memories.
This is like the where things grow, if you will. So like I said, this is kind of like planting a seed, and hopefully you guys can, you know, take care of this seed and make it sprout into something here in the valley.
Leva says he wants people to see it's not difficult to start something like this anywhere.
The materials, all the charcoal, all the water, everything that we need comes from Venmo. And it's usually to set up a thing like this is about $400, more or less.
He does crowdfunding on social media to pay for all the materials and food. It's now 3:30 in the afternoon and music plays over a speaker. The farm workers have just finished pruning almonds for the day. They walk out of the orchards to a road where Leva, Lopez, and other volunteers are waiting to serve them. On one end, Kendra Lopez hands out to-go containers filled with rice, beans, nopales, and a choice of chicken or carne asada. On the other end, volunteers are helping distribute PPE, hats, and winter gloves. Lopez, who organized the event, says the concept is pretty straightforward.
In terms of reaching out to our local community, maybe they're like, hey, my restaurant's closed, or hey, I don't have my taco stand right now, but I do have a grill. I can donate the grill. You can use it for this. And this is kind of how Helio came about doing his community cookout.
When it came to gathering items like hats and gloves for the cold weather, Lopez says she posted a call to action on social media. And she partnered with Ricardo Castorena from Centro Binacional, an organization that provides education on COVID, along with PPE to farm workers in the valley. Castorena says farm workers have been extremely impacted by the virus.
And they have very few resources. Just because they're working doesn't mean that they have everything that they need to sustain their lifestyles or that of their children, especially now that they're home.
He doesn't expect the cookout to solve all their problems, but he says it's a matter of perspective.
It's only one meal, but that meal could be like the best meal you've ever had, or it's the one that just lets you get to the next day. And really, that's kind of what it's all about.
48-year-old farm worker Jose Guadalupe says he does appreciate his sentiment.
This is good to see. You know, we work in the fields all day, so it's nice to be recognized and appreciated for our hard work.
Kendra Lopez says they're already planning their next cookout for farm workers in Riverdale on Tuesday. She's looking for volunteers to help make breakfast burritos and people to donate toys, school supplies, and socks. For more information, go to Central Valley Community Cookouts on Instagram. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Mari Bolaños.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. President-elect Joe Biden has pledged to end the Trump administration's travel ban on several Muslim-majority nations, including Iran. The impact could be big in California, home to the largest Iranian community in the nation. Our colleague at KQED, Farida Jahabvala Romero, spoke with an Iranian-American doctor near Fresno who has tried for years to bring his father to live with him.
In March, Armin Derry was consumed with worry. His father, also a doctor, got coronavirus from a patient in Tehran and was hospitalized.
He's 81 years old, and that's the biggest risk factor for COVID-19.
But Derry lives in Visalia, more than 7,000 miles away. That distance compounded his fear. He couldn't just go care for his dad.
That was a very tough time. It was very scary.
Derry and his sister are both naturalized U.S. citizens. 5 years ago, they applied for green cards for their parents. Their mother's was approved in 2016, but their father's got stuck in limbo after President Donald Trump issued the travel ban during his first days in office.
It's been a burden, a huge burden on our shoulders, on our minds. Yeah, it's been very difficult for all of us.
Trump invoked national security to bar travel to the U.S. for most people from some Muslim-majority nations. But critics challenged the ban in court as discriminatory and racist. An amended version didn't go into full effect until December 2017, after the Supreme Court allowed it to move forward. And earlier this year, Trump added more African and Asian nations, for a total of 13.
The harm that it has done to the reputation of the country and to the people and communities it's impacted is so immeasurable.
Max Wolson is an attorney with the National Immigration Law Center, which sued to end the travel ban. He says the impact goes way beyond the more than 41,000 visas the U.S. State Department has denied under the ban.
Every child that you keep separate from their parent, every person who misses a wedding and every person who misses a job opportunity, those don't just hurt the person involved. They hurt the people that would benefit from being reunited with their family members. They hurt the places that these people would end up working.
Biden could undo the travel ban just the way Trump started it, with an executive order. That would trigger a reversal at the State Department, Customs and Border Protection, and other federal agencies. Abed Ayyub, with the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, says if Biden ends the travel ban as promised, it would signal the start of a new era on how this country treats immigrants, including protecting dreamers and reuniting separated migrant families.
By overturning the ban, which is the lowest hanging fruit, he can signal to the communities that, you know what, I take immigration seriously. I take your concerns seriously.
Dr. Armin Derry says Getting rid of the ban would lift a weight off his family and many others, and it would help ease the feeling the travel ban gave him, that he wasn't welcome in America.
It's going to be a huge relief for people who are affected by this unjust and discriminative act. It means a lot for us.
His dad has recovered from COVID. Now Derry hopes he can finally come live with him in Visalia. For the California Report, I'm Farida Javala Romero.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Governor Gavin Newsom has a plan to use $750 million of federal coronavirus relief funds to purchase motels and other properties that will be converted into housing for those experiencing homelessness. But there's a catch. If the properties are not purchased by the end of the year, the money goes back to the federal government. To find out what this means for Fresno and Bakersfield, I spoke with Anna Lavin, Executive Director of the Bakersfield-Kern Regional Homeless Collaborative, Sonia De La Rosa, Principal Administrative Analyst for the Administrative Office of Fresno County, and Matt Levin, Housing Reporter for Cal Matters. Matt, you've done some outstanding reporting for Cal Matters on Project Home Key. Can you bring us up to speed on how that started as a temporary way to provide housing in light of the pandemic, but now has a shot at becoming a way to provide permanent shelter for some people experiencing homelessness?
Sure. So in April, way back when, Governor Newsom announced Project Room Key, which was the predecessor to Project Home Key. And Project Room Key was this emergency program that tried to lease as many hotel rooms as the state possibly could. And by state, I really mean local governments and counties, to bring in people experiencing homelessness from homeless shelters and encampments where public health authorities were very fearful that an outbreak could be incredibly problematic, not just to people experiencing homelessness, but to the broader public as well, you know, similar to what happened with the hepatitis outbreak in San Diego a few years back. So that project was able to, at its peak, house around 22,000 people in temporary hotels around the state. And then the thought was, well, what are we going to do with all of these people in these hotels now? And the optics of, you know, returning them to homelessness are pretty politically horrifying, both for local elected officials and the governor. So the next step was Project Home Key. This was the $800 million project launched in July, which attempts to buy as many properties as possible, mostly motels, and converts them to permanent homeless housing. And right now we are in the last stages, I would say, of all of these local governments trying to use that state money to buy motels within the next 30 days, because the dollars disappear like Cinderella at midnight at the end of the month.
So I do want to get into Project Home Key, but before we do, I want to go back to Project Room Key and just get a status update on where that funding stands in Fresno and Kern counties. So Sonia De La Rosa, can you tell us where things are at in Fresno County and what's going to happen to folks when that program ends?
Sure. So a little, and I think you'll find when you're asking questions about the project or Room Key, you'll find that folks implemented it differently depending on where you were located. For us, Matt mentioned April, we actually had to activate our beds pretty much at mid to near the end of March. And we had a developer that actually had purchased sites that were non-congregate and basically were old hotels. And we were able to convert them to COVID beds that allowed us to bring in over 300 people within the course of a month. And all of these were unit styles. They were not active hotels. They were actually properties that had been acquired by a developer here. And he turned over those properties for us to be able to use them as non-congregate shelter. So we brought in those individuals, and to date, At any given month, we have over 400 individuals that are using our properties on average and staying at one of these units or staying at one of our isolation hotels. So what we've done is actually plan to have these in place to the majority to March 2020 with the balance through June 2020. And the room key beds that will be in place will actually house many of these people. So we're not going to have people go exit into homelessness. They'll actually be transitioning into either one of our home key emergency beds or permanent housing beds.
Well, that's certainly good news. Mm-hmm. So Anna Lavin, Executive Director of the Bakersfield Kern Regional Homeless Collaborative, how are things standing in Kern County as it pertains to Project Room Key?
One of the things I should make mention is that in addition to the items that Matt mentioned, the state under Project Room Key also provided trailers if you were wanting to make use of those as another opportunity for non-congregate sheltering, and had provided quite a bit of flexibility for the use of the dollars so that we could also think about a scattered site hotel usage model as well. And for our community, what made most sense was to use the trailers to help support those who were recovering from COVID, and also to think about a scattered site model. But most importantly for us, we're part of what's called the Built for Zero best practices, which allow us to essentially solve for homelessness or address homelessness through a strong case management system. And we have been able to build essentially a case management list of those who are both at highest risk for COVID and negative outcomes, as well as those who did contract the illness and are recovering and potentially may have long-term negative impacts as a result of having contracted the illness. And so that's really been our focus for our community. And looking at that list, and if we can pivot a little bit to Project Home Key, that's really ultimately what our goal setting has been about, is what is the permanent housing solution outcome for this group that we really want to make sure maintains safety and health during a worldwide pandemic. And so we've been really excited because looking at our bynameless, we now have through Project Home Key, another 150 units of permanent supportive housing for these folks to be able to not only have housing, but have a strong case management connection to that housing. And for us, we know that that's always been the most successful model when it comes to making sure that folks not only achieve housing, but they're achieving long-term stability. And so we're really excited about that piece.
So Matt Levin, reporter for Cal Matters, I want to come back to you. You know, back in the before times, Governor Newsom was hyper-focused on addressing the homeless crisis in California. And now through Project Home Key potentially has an opportunity to really inject some serious funding into addressing this issue. If this works, how big of a dent could it make?
So I think it depends on how you define dent and for the project itself, how you define success. So in terms of getting a significant number of homeless housing units online in a very fast period of time. So we're talking statewide, an estimate of about 6,100 units in 6 months. The homelessness researchers and advocates I talk to say the state has never done anything like this, at least in the past few decades. Typically, homeless housing takes a long time to line up the financing for, to find a location for, to clear all the regulatory hurdles you need to clear. So the fact that they're able to get these many properties and these many units on board, if all of these purchases close, it is an achievement. The problem for Governor Newsom is the scope of homelessness in California, as most Californians know, is enormous. So it's, you know, at last count, which is a while back now, there's over 150,000 Californians without a safe, stable home. So even if you're able to get all of these units online, that may not make a really big dent in the visible homelessness you see, especially in some of the epicenters of homelessness around the state.
So, Sonia De La Rosa, I'd like to come back to you. Where does Fresno County stand right now when it comes to using these funds to purchase motel rooms, or motels, I should say?
So Fresno County submitted quite a few applications. The County of Fresno submitted one for 204 units. And then the Fresno Housing Authority submitted 5 different applications, which combined total about 300 new doors. So what's happening now is that we are coordinating with the Fresno Housing Authority and the City of Fresno to try to form a system as to how these folks will go into the different beds. So for Fresno Housing Authority beds, the majority of them will be emergency beds. Our beds through the County of Fresno will actually be permanent housing beds, a little different from permanent supportive housing, but still funded with emergency solutions grants, which requires case management for the rapid rehousing of those permanent housing beds that we're going to make available. And so the difference will be is that we're actually going to be able to move people from our current beds of about 400 into more permanent beds by doing it a household at a time. So we have 200 rooms that were made available to the County of Fresno's application. That's going to be 165 permanent units that folks can move into as soon as January. For us, we're going to be able to transition people from our emergency beds into the more permanent beds by beginning of January, and then in the future seek to convert the rooms completely to be permanent affordable housing for the same group of people that we're assisting now. So that's the way it'll translate for Fresno County.
Anna Lavin, you know, maybe you can tell us a little bit more about how the county is dealing with the deadlines that Project Home Key carries. It is essentially asking cities and counties to purchase these properties at breakneck speed. How is that going?
You're absolutely right. Essentially, we're condensing typical projects of 2 years in length into a 3-month cycle. We're really lucky that our housing authority, which was the applicant for all 4 of our locations, and we received a little less than $15 million for the purchase of those 4 properties and the conversion and rehabilitation, that our housing authority has been a very strong partner with the collaborative and is very dedicated in their mission to addressing homelessness in our community. And so while it was an extraordinary lift for them, they dove in with their energy and sense of passion for the mission. And we were successful in the application in the Tier 1 awards, which is really, really exciting for us. And I think part of that has to do with all of the foundational work that we've tried to do in partnering across our city with Bakersfield and Kern County and all of our homeless service providers to really allow us to be successful when opportunities like this come along. And I think to the point that was made earlier, we know that this was sort of a once in a lifetime or once in a couple of generations opportunity. And so we didn't want to let that pass us by. So they, although again, it was a large lift, they were able to move very, very quickly on it. And give a lot of strength to the application as it was a competitive process. And so we're really fortunate that all 4 locations were awarded. And by the end of December, if not early January, all of those spaces, that total of 150 units, will start to have occupied using our, what we refer to as a coordinated entry system. So we already have a prioritization system in place that allows us to know of who has the highest need and who's most vulnerable, including those who are at highest risk for COVID. And so I think we've situated ourselves pretty well to really kind of streamline the process to make sure that we get folks housed as quickly and resourcefully as possible.
Matt Levin, housing reporter for Cal Matters. I'd like to talk to you about the money here. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe this is a approximately $800 million project, which I'm sure our listeners are going to, you know, hear and just think that's an extraordinary amount of money. But where is that money coming from? And in what ways is this actually a really affordable way to provide housing for people experiencing homelessness?
Sure. So it's actually a little bit over $800 million. A small slice of that is coming from philanthropic organizations, Blue Shield, and I think Kaiser. But the lion's share of the money is actually coming from the federal government. So this is money that Congress passed in spring as part of the coronavirus relief package that was given to the states. And Newsom and state lawmakers decided to spend it on Project Home Key. And that's the reason why there's this December deadline and such a rush here, is because those federal dollars expire at the end of the year. So all these purchases have to be closed by then. In terms of the cost effectiveness here, I think you're right. I think a lot of Californians and a lot of your listeners will hear, God, $800 million. That is a lot of, right? We're nearing $1 billion. On a per unit basis, preliminarily, and these numbers aren't final, but the state says it's looking at about $146,000 per unit across the state. I think in Fresno and Kern County, that number is going to be lower, and the other panelists can attest to that. But again, that's a number that sounds really high, you know, $150,000 per unit. But when you compare that to the cost of building homeless housing, and particularly permanent supportive housing from scratch, it is cheaper. You know, looking at the cost of building homeless housing from scratch in, let's say, L.A., there was a city auditor report that found that it was $500,000 per unit. You know, that acquisition cost of $150,000 per unit, that doesn't include the cost of converting these motels or other properties to permanent housing, you know, installing like a kitchenette or a bathroom or something like that. And that's going to cost more money and drive costs up. But overall, this looks like it is going to be a cheaper approach to housing people experiencing homelessness than some of the previous alternatives.
Anna Lavin, Executive Director of the Bakersfield-Kern Regional Homeless Collaborative. Obviously, what we're talking about here is is one program, one slice of a really complicated pie when it comes to finding homes for people experiencing homelessness. And I'd like, before we wrap up, I'd just love to hear your thoughts about how you see Project Home Key fitting into this larger strategy.
Well, for us, always the strategy is about permanent housing solution. You know, our goal is to create a system where ultimately everyone in Kern County has a place to call home. And for us, that means we have to dive into housing. And I think one of the things that I would sort of reference back to is when we talk about cost, there's also so many unseen costs to the taxpayer for someone who is unsheltered. There's emergency room visits, there's the cost to our law enforcement and judicial systems, there are costs to code enforcement as well as our small business owners. There's a tremendous cost for anyone who is unsheltered. And so when we think about the cost per unit, what we really want to also juxtapose that with is the current cost of anyone who's already living on the streets. And really the beauty of when we're able to help someone transition, find stability, find health, find safety, and ultimately find that permanent housing solution. So for us, I think Project Home Key is a really critical piece to this puzzle. Because we know, and again, for us, we've chosen to go the direction of permanent supportive housing, which provides both the housing piece and the stability component through case management, that ultimately is where we find our solutions. And we also know that in California and Bakersfield, and I'm sure Fresno are not immune to this as well, that affordable housing is just lacking. And so whenever we have the ability to come upon 150 units, for us, that will really make a dent. It's quite significant. It's not where we should end. We definitely need to continue to push forward in those efforts. But ultimately, for us, the solution really is about providing housing and stability for folks.
Well, Anna Lavin, Executive Director of the Bakersfield-Kern Regional Homeless Collaborative, Sonia De La Rosa, Principal Administrative Analyst for the Fresno County Administrative Office, and Matt Levin, Housing Reporter for CalMatters. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Every week, it seems, the U.S. hits another record for COVID-19 cases or patients being treated in hospitals. For months, virus infections in California and the San Joaquin Valley had been holding steady, but things have taken a turn for the worst in the last few weeks. For more about this, and also some optimism, which seems in short supply, is FM 89 health reporter Carrie Klein with our weekly COVID-19 update. Welcome back, Carrie.
Hello, Kathleen.
So what can you tell us about what's shifted with the pandemic since our last update 2 weeks ago?
Well, a lot has, unfortunately, and as you summed up earlier, I don't really need to tell people that it's looking bad. You know, from a wider perspective, California and the entire country are seeing these record high caseloads and hospitalizations. Locally in the San Joaquin Valley, things aren't as dire, but that's not saying much. I mean, cases have been rising precipitously. Most counties here are seeing their highest caseloads in months since July and August when the last surge happened. The only two counties that are actually seeing record highs right now are Kings County and Mariposa, the only two counties in our region, I should say. However, health officials locally and statewide have said they expect cases to keep on rising because of the Thanksgiving holiday. We have yet to really see what impact gatherings during the holiday have had. Hospitals here are filling up, as are ICUs. We're not at critical capacity just yet, though, and I'll have more on that later on in this interview. Also, deaths due to COVID-19 have not yet caught up to what's been happening with caseloads, but we are likely to see, you know, a rise in people dying sometime soon. You know, if we want to talk about the blueprint for a safer economy, you know, all of the counties in our region are in purple. Almost all of the counties in the entire state are in the purple tier, except for Mariposa, which was knocked down two levels from yellow to the red tier. And I also want to talk about what Governor Newsom has been talking about. He's given a couple of press conferences this week, and he's been sharing a lot of really alarming data and statistics. And one of those is that the state projects that ICUs will be filled beyond capacity by the end of this month. And that's for the entire state. Really quite alarming. And because of that dwindling capacity, Newsom has warned that he will be instituting regional lockdowns imminently. And those will be triggered when less than 15% of ICU capacity is available. And that's in any number of regions in the state. One of them is the San Joaquin Valley. And when that's triggered, we will enter a three-week stay-at-home order where non-essential travel will be restricted and then more business sectors will be closed down as well. Our ICUs are not crowded enough yet to trigger the stay-at-home order, but Newsom's health team estimates we will be there within the next week or so, along with most of the rest of the state.
That does certainly sound dire. But you said that hospitals are not full to capacity yet. What kind of COVID loads are they dealing with right now?
Well, right now, the number of COVID patients in local hospitals is still lower than the surge that we saw in late July. So right now, we have close to 800 COVID patients in hospital beds in our seven-county area. But on July 23rd, which was the record here in this area, there were 20% more patients in hospitals then. So we have a little ways to go before we hit that critical number. And ICUs, too, still have space.
But what happens when hospitals do approach their capacities?
Well, for that, I spoke with Dr. Iyad Al-Masri. He's a pulmonologist and critical care physician with UCSF Fresno Med School and Community Regional Medical Center. He actually spends most of his clinical hours in the ICU. He says that California has had the benefit of time. Because our first wave didn't hit until the summer, we could learn from the catastrophes in New York, in Seattle, the East Coast, Italy. You know, hospitals here had time to work out surge plans that first time around. And so now it's a matter of repeating those plans with lessons learned from the summer.
Luckily, we have contingency plans. So as I told you, we had the benefit of time and seeing what happened to others. So we pooled a lot of resources and we have flexible areas that, for example, that was used for preoperative assessment before outpatient procedures. We could turn those in few days into ICU beds. We have extra ventilators. So we can increase our ICU bed capacity from about 108 in this hospital up to 200 if needed.
Of course, he's talking specifically about Community Regional Medical Center, but many other hospital systems that I've spoken with have told me similar things about, you know, being able to reclaim spaces and beds for COVID care around the hospital.
But I remember you telling me that in most hospitals around here, the limiting factor in treating COVID patients isn't beds, but staff. How are hospitals planning for that?
Yeah, and that is a critical point, especially because right now, Community Medical Centers reports that more than 350 employees are in isolation, either because they've come down with COVID or they've had close exposure to someone who is and they need to be in quarantine. And Al-Masri says this is obviously a huge concern.
It's not only life-threatening illness, or at least potentially life-threatening illness. You're out of work for 2 weeks, which is already a strained system.
Now, over the summer, local hospitals did have help from teams of military-trained doctors. Many also took on traveling nurses, but with so many hospitals around the country in desperate need of help right now, it's unclear how much we locally will be able to take advantage of those tools this time around.
And what about that so-called alternate care site in Porterville? Will that site be able to take on overflow patients from hospitals like it did over the summer?
Yeah, that site is ready with 123 beds. Over the summer, it was never used for more than a few dozen patients at once, even when the caseloads got really bad. So there is a lot of space available there. And also the Fresno Convention Center is being now listed as an alternate care site. And that one has 125 beds. Both of those are considered in warm status. So they have staff on standby, ready to mobilize when necessary. Obviously, it is not ideal to be in a convention center instead of a hospital if you're sick, but typically these sites, they take on the milder cases, you know, often those who are on the upswing from the virus, and they just need occasional monitoring, maybe some oxygen, rather than really acute care.
So it sounds like not all bad news, at least at the moment.
Yeah, that's right. And Dr. Al-Masri says there's more reason to be optimistic as well.
In Fresno County, for example, our case mortality is less than 2%. In other words, out of each 100 patients who were confirmed to have COVID infection, less than 2 are expected to die. And that actually is in line with all California, and it is better than the national average.
And so from his perspective, it means that what local hospitals are doing is working and it's saving lives.
And then it feels like we are tantalizingly close to a vaccine. Are we?
Well, the U.S., you know, has not officially approved a vaccine just yet, but we are getting ready to start distributing them whenever they are approved. Like one of them has been in the U.K., which is very exciting. Governor Newsom has said that California, that whenever we do get a vaccine, California has been granted 327,000 doses in that first shipment, which will be good for a little over 160,000 people because each person will need 2 doses. The state has not revealed a whole lot of details about how those will be distributed, but healthcare workers at least will be on that first priority list. And for what it's worth, Dr. Al-Masri said he absolutely trusts the companies producing these vaccines, and he absolutely trusts that the FDA did not cut corners. And he says if he can, he'd be first in line to take it.
Well, as always, thank you so much for your reporting, Carrie.
Thank you, Kathleen.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. After theaters went dark as a result of the pandemic, Fresno native turned Broadway performer Salisha Thomas launched a new project in which she explores one of her favorite topics of conversation, her hair. In the new podcast, Black Hair in the Big Leagues, Thomas uses hair as a launching point to discuss identity, culture, and self-esteem. I spoke with Thomas about the project, but first asked her to share her journey from Fresno's Bullard High School to Broadway.
Growing up, I wanted to be whatever would make the most money, which was, I'm like, okay, I'll be a neurosurgeon. Studied about that. I was like, oh, I hate blood. I'll be a lawyer. Yes, that's right. That's what I'll be. And I loved everything. I was in mock trial at Bullard, all in leadership. And my theater teacher was like, do you really want to be a lawyer? Or do you want to act like a lawyer? And, you know, my senior year in high school, I ended up running for the Miss Fresno County pageant and I needed a talent. And so I like done theater growing up, but it was always ensemble singing. And for the Miss Fresno County pageant, that was the first time I like had a solo. And so I got voice lessons, and I really like this. So I ended up majoring in musical theater in college at Cal State Fullerton, graduated, became a vocalist at Disneyland. I loved working for Disney. I loved it. And then my days got cut down to one day a week. I'm like, what am I supposed to do with this? And so I actually went out to New York City to visit. And the day I got there, oh my gosh, I fell in love. I fell so in love. And I wanted to move, but I was like, I can't just uproot my life in California just in a day, can I? And after a week of being there, I met this homeless man who sat down next to me waiting for the train. And he was like, I don't know who you are, but you need to move here and you need to do it now. And my whole body was covered in goosebumps.
Wow. What a story.
Yeah. And long, like this can be a very long story, but long story short, I put my notice into Disney that day and had officially moved back to the city 2 weeks later. So I went to California, sold everything, got back to New York. And the week I got back to New York, I heard about and booked the first national tour of Beautiful, the Carole King musical. And I toured with that show for 2 years and then eventually made my Broadway debut with that show in New York. And closed the show on Broadway last year.
Wow. Well, let's jump ahead to now, pandemic time. So you were all set to perform in the planned Britney Spears musical when the theaters went dark because of the pandemic. But you have been keeping yourself busy during these months. Tell us about your new podcast.
Oh my gosh. Thank you for asking. Okay. So the thing with Broadway is, it's so much fun to go to work and you go to the dressing room and you don't even need to know what the Broadway news is because you go to the dressing room, everyone's talking about whatever is happening in the industry. And since the shutdown, I don't get to go to a rehearsal. I don't get to go to work. And here, I feel so left out. And also, I'm missing my friends. I'm missing community. And I was kind of thinking like, what can I do to feel like I'm a part of this industry that I miss so much? And I thought like, okay, well, what can I talk about? Because I did want to start a podcast, but I had zero idea. I'm like, what am I going to talk about? And I realized, I'm like, well, when I'm in a dressing room, we talk about hair all day, every day, 6 days a week. Truly, and we can talk about it for forever. And so I thought, you know what? What a great excuse. I could just call up my friends and we'll talk about hair. And in doing so, it feels like these coffee dates. It feels like I'm catching up with my friends one-on-one and we're talking about things that we would be talking about if we were in person together, except we're recording the conversation. And, you know, it's something that other people can listen to. And what I love about it, like selfishly, it feels like I have connection with my friend, like with the industry again, with community. And that is what makes me like fill up my schedule with so many interviews each week to feel that sense of community.
Absolutely. So would you agree that for Black women, what we choose to do with our hair is both a personal choice, obviously, but also a political statement?
Oh my gosh. Yes. Yes. For so long, we've like been taught like, okay, well, at least where I'm from, when you go to something that is an important event, anything where you need to like look nice, I've always been, you got to beat your hair into submission. You cannot walk out the house with your hair looking any kind of way. And so I've always been taught, okay, I got to straighten it. Okay. I got to cover it. Okay. I got to do whatever I have to do so that you can't see what it actually looks like. That is how it's always been, especially doing pageants in Orange County. And so I'm realizing wearing my hair natural it's revolutionary. And I'm like, wait, why is it revolutionary? We need to change that. Like it should be normal. It shouldn't be a big deal that we're wearing it the way it grows out of our head.
Absolutely. I absolutely know what you mean. So you and I both wore our hair straight for many years before we decided to embrace our natural texture. Wow. Talk me through that process for you. What led you to make that decision?
I mean, honestly, so I've straightened my hair ever since the fourth grade, and I loved a good blowout all through high school, all through college. And then I got a couple of weaves, not many weaves, but when I went on tour with Beautiful, I discovered wigs. And when I discovered wigs, like as well, like on stage, as well as off the stage, my natural hair never saw the light of day. I was like, oh my gosh, this is great. I can just forget about my natural hair forever and only wear wigs. But it got to the point where I neglected my own hair so severely. It was disgusting. It was terrible. And I always wondered, like, I would look at girls, like black girls, but like white girls, and be like, wow, you can just wear your hair without adding extra hair, or you just wear it like it was such an anomaly to me. And when I got to the Broadway company of Beautiful, everyone was always talking about their natural hair and their hair journey. And I felt so left out because I was always hiding mine. And I decided, okay, let me just see what happens if I just, okay, let me go cut off the dead and stop straightening my hair. 2018, I was like, all right, I'm not going to put heat on my hair for a year. And it was, transitioning is so tough because I felt so ugly. Oh my gosh. But I learned, like, okay, just be patient. And I kind of started to like it. And started to get used to not running to get a blowout every other week. And, you know, after you start to see progress, it's easier to like lean in when you can see progress. And that's the same for fitness too. It's like, if you're doing a weight loss journey and you finally lose 5 pounds, it's like, okay, wait a minute. Let me do a little bit more. And that's how it was with my hair. And then eventually I'm like, okay, wait, my hair has grown out and I'm starting to get compliments on it. Let's lean all the way freaking in. Let's do this thing.
That's fantastic. Salisha Thomas, host of Black Hair in the Big Leagues, thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me, Kathleen.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Madi Bolaños, and Sarith Hawk. Technical support is from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in Californians' decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.